The year was 1914. Ernest Shackleton, you may not know that name unless you know a little bit about history, but he is the most important name in the discovery of the Antarctica. He was leaving England in his third trip with the British Royal Navy in the exploration of the Antarctica. But there was a war going on. World War II had begun already. But they left in this thousands of mile journey to one of the coldest spots on the face of the earth. That third journey didn't go so well. The ship called Endurance actually became frozen in the ice. For 8 months it sat there, and when the ice broke enough, the ship sunk. But the men found themselves floating on huge pieces of ice for months. They finally arrived at Elephant Island, which is part of the Antarctica, just a giant mountain of ice. Shackleton left all the men there except for five of them, and in a very small boat, traveled 1,300 kilometers, that's about 800 miles, to the Falkland Islands, to South Georgia Island. Landed on one side, trekked all the way to the other side to a whaling station. He was eventually able to go back, rescue all of his men, and they made it back to England safe. But I tell you the story because the journey had taken 2 years to this point. And when he arrived to that whaling station on South Georgia Island, they hadn't had any contact for 2 years with anyone. So he said, "Mr. Sorley, tell me, when was the war over?" "The war's not over," Mr. Sorley answered. "Millions are being killed. Europe is mad. The world is mad." Ernest Shackleton and his men were completely out of touch with the world. They knew nothing. The war would go for 2 more years before there would be a signing of an armistice. We are in a study of Jesus' life, and now we are beginning to study his death and his crucifixion and his resurrection. As he goes through the Last Supper and his prayer in Gethsemane, in the Garden of Gethsemane, and when he, through the trials and the crucifixion, his disciples are completely out of touch. It's as if they are like Ernest Shackleton. They have no idea what is going on. Not until you really study the Gospels clearly do you see how clueless the disciples are. It will be long after Jesus is gone before they are ever brought to the realization of who Jesus is and what actually happened, despite the fact they've spent 3.5 years with him in ministry. Let me read the passage that we are going to look at today. It is the passage that shows us Jesus' prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. I'm beginning at Luke chapter 22, verses 39 through 46. Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down, and prayed, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." An angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. When he rose from prayer, he went back to his disciples. He found them asleep, exhausted from sorrow. "Why are you sleeping?" he asked them. "Get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation." We looked over the last couple of weeks at the story of the Last Supper. Jesus was excited to be able to eat the Last Supper with his disciples, but he, Jesus, experienced enormous disappointment. First, there was Judas, who betrayed him, and he went out into the night from that supper to betray him. That was a huge disappointment to Jesus. Then there was an argument that broke out at the Last Supper. Who was going to be the greatest of the disciples? That was of disappointment. Then Jesus broke the news to Peter that He, like the other disciples, were not prepared for what was ahead. They should depend on the Lord. Peter insisted that he was prepared to die, face anything. And Jesus said, "You're not, Peter. You're going to deny me three times." That was all disappointing. Jesus left that supper with his disciples, 11 of them. Judas had gone, never to return. He went into a very common and known place in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's on the Mount of Olives. His disciples followed him, verse 39 says. It was his usual place. Verse 40, on reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." This was instruction that they would begin to pray for what was about to happen to him and to them. But it was difficult for them to comprehend that. In this prayer, we are allowed to see a Jesus that we have seen in no other page of the Gospels. This is a different Jesus than we have ever seen before. This is a very sacred prayer. We are allowed to enter into a conversation, to hear a conversation that was only a conversation between Jesus and his Father. This Jesus we see here is a Jesus we are unfamiliar with, a Jesus who is overwhelmed with fear. He has never experienced fear. He has never shown us fear at all. Let's review quickly. Jesus began his ministry right after baptism by going into the desert for 40 days of fasting, where he did battle face to face with Satan. But he was fearless in his encounters with Satan. He was immovable. He went to his hometown of Nazareth. They rejected him, and they actually tried to kill him, and they were going to catch him and throw him over a cliff, but he fearlessly escaped them, eluded them. Jesus silenced demons with a simple, "Be quiet." And they obeyed. He was fearless in his preaching to the Pharisees, scorching sermons against their hypocrisy. He taught in the temple with authority, even though the authorities tried every trap they could, but they failed. Jesus' encounters with them show courage and fearlessness. He was courageous in his approach to death, even coming to Jerusalem. Look at these verses, Luke 9:44. "Listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." And in verse 51, "As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem." And before he began the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, he said this in Luke 18, "Jesus took the 12 aside and told them, 'We are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written by the prophets about the Son of Man," that's himself, "will be fulfilled. He will be handed over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, insult him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. On the third day, he will rise again.'" He never exhibited fear, not even when talking about it. But now he has this dread, this overwhelming dread. Let's look at the verses again. Let's read them out of Mark chapter 14, verse 33. "He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. 'My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death,' he said. 'Stay here and keep watch.'" Deeply distressed. The King James actually says, "sore amazed," almost astonished at this overwhelming fear that came on him. Luke says in verse 43 and 44 that it was so overwhelming that an angel was dispatched from heaven to immediately attend to the Lord. "An angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly as his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. No open wound, yet the pores opened up and his blood actually passed out." The drops of perspiration were red. This was agony as Jesus confronted this emotion of sorrow and sadness and fear inside. But why are we surprised by fear? There have been people face death fearlessly. We have record of people who have faced death without even fear. When Napoleon was finalizing his kingdom, he ordered the deaths of people he thought were a threat. One of them was the king of Naples, his own brother-in-law. The man had been a commanding general of the armies of France. The record is clear that when Murat, his name, died, this is what happened. On the day of his death, he took a shock of his hair, cut off, and asked one of the officers to enclose it with a letter he had written to his wife. Napoleon's sister and his children, who were then all living in Trieste. Then Murat took off his watch and gave it to the officer as a gift. But before he parted with the watch, he removed from its lid a tiny carnelian on which was carved a portrait of his wife. Murat held the carnelian tightly in the palm of his hand as he followed the soldiers out of the courtyard where they were preparing to kill him. The sergeant of the firing squad offered Murat a chair, but Murat said he wanted to die standing up. The sergeant offered to cover up his eyes with a cloth, but Murat said he wanted to die with his eyes open. "I do have one request," Murat then said. "I have commanded in many battles, and now I would like to give the word of command for the last time. The sergeant granted his wish. Murat then stood against the wall of the castle and called out in a loud voice, "Soldiers, form line." 6 soldiers drew themselves up to within about 10 feet of him. "Prepare arms, present." The soldiers pointed their muskets at him. "Aim at the heart, save the face," Murat said with a little smile. And then after he held up his hand to look for the final time at the carnelian showing the portrait of his wife, he issued the final command, "Fire." It's a record of bravery, courage. Doesn't seem to be any fear of death. Why was Jesus afraid in the Garden of Gethsemane when his whole life he had never been afraid? We have the answer in the Bible very clear. This fear that Jesus experiences in the Garden of Gethsemane is not a fear of the physical death of which he will confront. It is the fear of the spiritual death he is about to experience. I'm going to read to you 4 scriptures. Each of them are very important scriptures that describe for us why Jesus was facing the agony and the horrifying fear that overwhelmed him. Look at these verses carefully. The first part of Romans 6:23 says it all. "For the wages of sin is death." This man in the garden, Jesus, is sinless. He has never sinned. And that verse says, "The wages of sin is death." He is going to die. Romans 5:12, "Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, in this way death came to all men, because all sinned," but not all, not Jesus, but he would die the death of a sinner. Paul summed it up in the most articulate fashion when he wrote his second letter to the Corinthians. "God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." God made him who had no sin to be sin for us. And 1 John 2:2, "He is the atoning sacrifice for our sins, not only for ours, but for the sins of the whole world." What brought the agony and the fear was the thought of sin and the burden he was about to bear. He knew no sin, yet he was about to become sin for us. Look at Jesus' prayer again in verse 41. "He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them," his disciples, "knelt down and prayed." Now we're going to spend considerable time looking at verse 42. One sentence, but this sentence has some powerful, powerful lessons for us today. "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." Let's begin with how he began the prayer, "Father." This is the only word Jesus ever used for God. And it's not "Father," the word we have here in English, is not really the real powerful translation. The word he used was "Abba" or "Daddy." I only called my father "Daddy." I never called him any other word. It wouldn't have been right. My children only call me daddy. Jesus, in the Gospels, more than 60 times refers to God, but he always says, Abba, Father. And this is how he began his prayer, Father. The relationship between Jesus and his Father was an unbroken relationship. Luke 11:13 is just one of the many examples how Jesus often referred to the relationship between he and his Father. If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give the Holy Spirit to those who ask him? He's referring to his Father who gives good gifts. John 8:29, the one who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, for I always do what pleases him. We must remind ourselves that this is a real prayer that Jesus is praying in the garden. This is real emotion, real agony. He says, if you are willing, Father, if you are willing. This is where the heart of the prayer is right here. He's addressing this to the disposition of his Father, who is willing to do anything for the Son. Jesus told the rich young ruler that it was impossible for a rich man to get into heaven. With men, things are impossible. With God, nothing is impossible. If it's possible, let this cup pass from me, he is saying. Had that ever happened? It did with Israel. Judah had to drink a terrible cup of destruction, yet God eventually passed that same cup to their destroyers, to their tormentors. Would he do that for Jesus? Because that's what Jesus is praying here. Take this cup from me. When you see this prayer, when you see Jesus in that garden praying, you're seeing what the incarnation is. Jesus placed his omniscience at the disposition of the Father. He's no longer omnipresent. He has placed that all at the hands of the Father. He experiences real pain. This is a real prayer prayed by a real man in a real moment of agony. That's why Jesus truly knows our every weakness and every emotion that we can ever experience on the whole spectrum of human emotion. Is there any way, what he is saying, is there any way, Father, to avoid the shame of this sin? But the cross demanded that Jesus bear the load for all of us. Take this cup from me, he says. What is in the cup? Filth. I want you for a moment to think about the most horrific filth you have ever seen or come across your mind. For instance, I'll give you an example. Living here in St. Louis, I have seen in the almost 20 years I've been here, numerous occasions where usually some boyfriend or stepfather has taken a little baby, and this just happened a few months ago, where the guy was taking care of the baby while the mother worked, and he was body slamming a little baby. And the baby killed the baby. But we've seen it where we've seen it in the paper where it's come out where they've actually slung the baby against the wall or killed the baby. I've even read where they've put a child in an oven. Horrific, horrific. As we look back over the world, there have been Holocausts. We often think of the Jewish Holocaust with the Nazis. But there have been many Holocausts during World War I. The world was mad. And Turkey decided, we don't like the Armenians. They lived in Turkey. The world was busy, so the Armenians decided, the Turkish government decided, let's kill the Armenians. And they killed 1.5 million Turkish people. Just killed them, because they didn't like them. Who was going to stop them? The world was at war. Every country was fighting against somebody. So who would stop them from killing 1.5 million people? There have been many Holocausts like that. That was in the cup. Your past was in the cup. My past was in the cup. That's what brought the fear and the agony to Jesus. When he looked at the cup, it repulsed him. Yet with all of that honest assessment of emotion, his prayer ended like this, not my will, but yours be done. What a small word, yet, or but. Depends on how you translate it, but what a big difference it makes. Remember the Hebrews who refused to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol? And he said, then you're going to be cast into this fiery furnace. And they said, we won't bow down to your idol, even if you cast us in there. Our God's able to deliver us from that. But even if he doesn't, we won't. Jesus says, I can't drink that cup if there's any way you can take this cup from me. Yet not my will, your will be done. We don't know too much about this kind of prayer. But this is the kind of prayer we are asked to pray. To pray for God's will. When you're facing a situation that is so complicated in life, whether it's with your health, whether it's with your family, I encourage you to pray God's will. Sometimes we are afraid to pray that because we are so convinced we want everything to go this way. Jesus is being honest. This is, and there's nothing wrong with praying like Jesus prayed. This is what I would like to see happen here, God. Would you do this? Just end it with, God, but what I want most is your will. Nothing brings peace like praying for God's will. Let's read it one more time. The whole verse 42. Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. The Father was willing. But he knew there was no other way. Yet not my will, but yours be done. 1 John 2:17 says, the world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever. That's my desire. Just a man who does God's will. Just a woman who does God's will. The writer of the book of Hebrews remembers back to this prayer when Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. Let's see what he has to say about this moment. Hebrews 5:7. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. What was he submitting to? He's submitting to God. He was submitting to the will of God. All prayers of faith end with thy will be done. The disciples, Jesus went back to them. Luke doesn't say it, but Matthew and Mark tell us Jesus went back three different times. And every time he finds them asleep, they were tired. They had it had been rough days, but they were out of touch with what was going on. And each time Jesus warns them about temptation and to pray. He says in verse 45, when he rose from prayer and he went back to his disciples, he found them sleeping, exhausted from sorrow. Why are you sleeping? He asked them, get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. Let me just give us some lessons, quick lessons here at the end, some takeaway from this for us today. Number one, I want you to know how God looks at sin and how much it costs God to take away your sin. When you look at this prayer, Jesus, who is in a human body, praying to an omnipotent Father, there isn't anything that he can't do. He's agonizing. He wouldn't take the cup away. What a blasphemous affront to God to think that sin doesn't matter. What an outrage to imagine that we are good enough for God to accept us as we are. What an affront to hold that there is any way apart from Jesus to get to God. What a slur to say that God doesn't care about us if he was willing to give up his own son. John says, this is the one of the disciples, and later in his first letter, how great is the love of the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know him. And the most famous verse in the Bible is appropriate here. For God so loved the world that he wouldn't take the cup away. That he gave his one and only son, because he wouldn't take the cup. That whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. That's the first lesson. Let us look at sin the way God looks at sin. The second lesson is, let us take a renewed commitment to prayer. But the kind of prayer that prays for God's will, obedience to God's will, submission to God's will in our lives. Let us look at the disciples for a moment and understand that if we're going to be able to overcome temptation and to be able to resist it, we're going to have to pray and ask God for his help, because in ourselves we're going to be inadequate against sexual sin, against materialistic views overwhelming us, against complacency in our relationship with God. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, no temptation has seized you except what is common to man, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. But if you don't pray, you won't find the way out. The temptation will overwhelm you. Only people who pray will have the insight and the fortitude and the help of God to find the way out. Lastly, let's consider what the death of Jesus actually meant for us. The agony, the fear that Jesus felt, the first time we've ever seen this emotion in Jesus, because it's the fear not of physical death, but of spiritual death. Later, he is on the cross. Nails are through his feet and through his hands. And he cries out. Jesus spoke several languages. He spoke Hebrew as a Jew. He spoke Aramaic, which was the language of the day. He spoke Latin, which was the language of transaction, and probably Greek. But the language that Jesus spoke from the cross was Aramaic, the language that most all people spoke in. And the words are recorded for us in the very Aramaic language, and then they're translated for us. Matthew 27:46. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eli, Eli, which is God. God, God, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's the moment that Jesus dreaded. That's the cup that he drank to the bitter dregs. Luther said of this moment, mystery of mystery, God deserts God. We see the Son of God, blood like sweat, and listen as he wrestles with death and wrath. We hear Jesus cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why? Paul said it in this verse. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God.